At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. This week, it is such a pleasure to introduce a longtime Twitter acquaintance turned friend, author Dwayne Swierczynski, to listeners. Dwayne Swierczynski is the New York Times best-selling and two-time Edgar-nominated author of 10 novels, including Revolver and Canary, many of which are in development for film and TV, as well as the graphic novel Breakneck. Most recently, Dwayne released the book California Bear and co-authored Lion and Lamb with James Patterson and co-scripted James Patterson's The Guilty, an Audible original starring John Lithgow and Bryce Dallas Howard. He lives in Southern California with his family. Dwayne, I want to thank you so much for being here. It was such a pleasure to finally meet you. I know we followed each other for years. You're a fellow film lover and a terrific writer. And I loved hosting you along with Patrick Milligan at Poison Pen for California Bear. So thanks so much for being here on one of your many California Bear stops.
Oh, thank you, Jen. Thank you so much. It was awesome meeting you. Yeah, after years of being a fan of you and your podcast, it was kind of surreal. Like, oh, there you are in person in real life. Cool. It's always odd. I mean, meeting folks you know virtually, but it was great. I'm sorry for bringing rain to your town. I heard that I was responsible for the rain, but you know,
the rain is still here, so I don't think it's you. But What's going on with the rains in LA? Because I know it was raining, then you guys had an earthquake or two. Yeah.
It's end time stuff. No, it was last week. I guess we're taping this, you know, Monday last week. The worst days were like Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And it was pretty severe. It was, I mean, for me, I'm from the East Coast, so I'm like, rain, whatever. I'm used to, you know, fighting snow, but the rain's real out here. I was surprised. And certain roadways aren't built for rain, you know, and it's, I was worried about, you know, hydroplaning and other cars hydroplaning.
Yeah, it's like the further west you get, because I'm from the Midwest too, it's like people have no idea how to drive in any other weather. So yeah. I remember like the first time I was on a highway in Phoenix when it was raining, people just like stopped essentially when it was raining pretty hard. Like, oh no, what do we do? And I was what are you guys doing? You know, I'm used to blizzards and ice and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And, we have a lot of flooding out here. So it is kind of because of the hard ground and elevation with mountains. So you just never know. But I think the rains are starting to go away here because we're kind of in the same system as LA, which is good. I know everyone listening is like, why are they talking about the weather? But you know what? We're adding a little color to your life is what we're doing. But
and the topic, it's on topic too. It's SoCal, you know, noir and neo-noir, you know, detective stories. So the rain is an essential element to noir and like, you know, dark detective stories. So, you know, it's on topic, I say.
Yes, it is. Yeah. SoCal noir for sure. And we were kind of throwing around a lot of ideas for a little bit. We were thinking California Hang movies. Dwayne wrote a really great piece. Is it for Crime Reads, I believe?
Yes,
Yes.
thank you.
On some of his favorite California Hang movies, including Cisco Pike. This is an audio podcast, so again, I'm kind of ruining it for everyone. But in the video, right behind him is a cool poster of Cisco Pike. I should take
right.
a screenshot here of Dwayne and his poster. But yes, so we were thinking that. We were thinking all kinds of directions we could have gone in. But mainly, we wanted to make it revolve around California Bear and the world of that. So for those listening who haven't read your book yet or haven't, you know, listened or watched the YouTube playback of our event at Poison Pen,
right?
Tell us about California Bear.
Sure. I mean, yeah, we finally landed on it. Our topic is like SoCal amateur detectives.
Yes.
And the book is kind of about that. It's about how, you know, a team of like really a motley crew of amateur detectives come together to catch a serial killer who has gone, you know, sort of, he's been sort of uncaught for about, you know, 40 years almost. That's kind of fun. It was inspired by, really briefly, you know, a piece I read about an ex-cop who decided to free wrongfully convicted felons. And I thought, wow, how cool is that? You free someone from prison after, you know, four decades. And what's that first beer like, for instance? You know, how'd that go? It was also inspired by Michelle McNamara's book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, about, you know,
yeah.
the hunt for the Golden State Killer. And that blew my mind because it's like, wow, imagine living next door to like this grandpa looking guy who turns out to be like, you know, some maniac who was never caught. That's gotta be, you know, a shocker. So the basic premise of the book is, you know, an ex-cop sort of pushes an ex-con into blackmailing an ex-serial killer eventually. And then it goes wrong from there. It was inspired. It was, you know, meant to be kind of a funny caper kind of story. I was inspired by my, you know, real life story of my daughter 5 years ago was diagnosed with leukemia. And I wrote part of this book in the hospital, her hospital room with her. And she, you know, I realized I was trying to escape that room, but also I was trying to deal with what was happening in that room at the same time, because there's a character, you know, very much inspired by her in the book. So anyway, that's a long story for a very short question, but yeah, California Bear, I think, inspire at least this you know, this our topic today, which I'm really excited to get into with you and, you know, trade some notes about
yeah,
these movies.
I loved your book. It's a good blend of kind of comedy. There are thrills. There's so many twists. And I think the girl detective who is inspired by your daughter is such a phenomenal character. She completely wins your heart. You realize she's one of those kids who was born like 40 years old. That's kind of the joke in my family. My dad's like, she was never a toddler. She was born 40. And so I really loved the character that was inspired by your daughter, Evelyn. And it's just a really great book. I was a little worried going in when I heard serial killers, because I am a little bit of a chicken on some of that. But you know what? You're really funny. You have, as you were pointing out, somebody on one of your tour stops was asking you about the number of food references you have, because you do some clever things with food, Nutter Butters, donuts, all kinds of stuff. We're not going to get into spoilery territory.
Right.
But there's so much to this book, and I urge everyone listening to pick it up. Yeah.
No, thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You mentioned at our event that, you know, you're at 16 years old, you were kind of the film trivia ringer that they would bring you in, which definitely strike me as an old soul who, you know, maybe, you know, the reincarnation didn't fully take the memory erasure. You just remember all this cool stuff from your previous life. I don't know how that works exactly, but yeah, you seem like you're, you know, well beyond, you know, your years in terms of wisdom.
Thank
knowledge.
You. Yeah, I know we were kind of talking about our backgrounds a little bit, and I loved some of your stories as well, and how you always enjoyed writing in books, but you had a background also in bars at a young age.
Sure.
For me, it was trivia. Neither of us were really big. We weren't drinkers. We were there for other reasons.
Right.
Dwayne was a keyboard player in his dad's band, which I love that story. Yes.
Yeah, I played basically, my motivation was playing for tips. So I played Donkey Kong, the machine, and like get all the, you know, all the cool free Cokes you wanted and bags of potato chips. That for a 10-year-old, that's awesome. So I would, you know, do that forever. was
Yeah,
cool.
it's cool. You have all this stuff to kind of go back on for your novels, essentially. And also, I read The Wheel Man, which is a great book that
Oh,
I
thank you.
tracked down our mutual friends, Jed Ayers, Bill
Yes.
Boyle, Jordan Harper, Nikki Dolson. They were all raving about your back catalog. So I had a lot of fun tracking down some of
Oh,
the
wow.
older books. And I loved that concept. You have a getaway driver, this Irish guy who's mute. It's such a good idea of a story. You're always kind of taking these sort of the tropes that we usually get in the crime field, but then doing something unexpected with them, which is what I love. Like we have a serial killer in California Bear, but in a different way than you would normally expect, and it's cool.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, that is honestly a motivation. I really try to, like, I love the classical tropes, but I think, how can I subvert them? How can I twist them around? And, like, believe me, the last thing I wanted to write was a serial killer novel. It was like, there's enough of them. But I could not do this. Once I had the idea for it, I'm like, no, I can do this different, maybe, And there's a big difference between this, and other serial killer books. It's sort of spoilerish, but it's a very different version of that story, which I love these. I love them. I love Zodiac. I love Mindhunter. All these, like, I'm part scaredy cat too, but I grew up watching a lot of inappropriate horror movies. So, I mean, going back to 10 Till Midnight, that Charles Bronson movie, it was always fascinating, like, about how you catch a killer. I watched that when I was probably way too young. I'm gonna say 12. I shouldn't have watched that at 12 years old. That was a mistake. But it got me thinking about crime and killers and such at a very young age. Anyway, yeah, I always try to make it different, because otherwise, why write the same thing that others have written? Might as well try to be weird.
Yeah,
That's my
and I
motto.
love the idea too of California detectives because, I mean, growing up in the 80s, 70s, around this era, we have, of course, Jim Rockford and we have Columbo and all of these great larger than life TV detectives.
Oh,
And
yeah.
it kind of continued on. But this was a cool idea to kind of look at amateurs or movies that maybe don't get enough love or people don't remember them as much. So the ones we arrived on, I voted for The Late Show, which I'm kind of like, some people listening are going to be like, Jen, that guy is a professional detective, but Lily Tomlin isn't.
But
So he's kind of,
exactly.
kind of riding along, sort of like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. You do have somebody who is a detective, but then you have Robert Downey Jr. and Michelle Monaghan and, they're all
Great
that.
comparison. Yeah,
Yeah, which is
that's
another movie I love very much. Cutter's Way is another film we're going to be talking about, which is terrific. And also Mike's Murder, which is the one that was the newest to me. I actually watched it for the first time in January just because I stumbled on it. My friend Drew graciously gives me access to his Plex server of old titles. And he's, kind of the expert on 80s cinema. And so his 80s catalog is amazing. And I just found it in there. I love tennis. So I loved the idea of, wait a minute, there's a female detective, but she's not really a detective, but there's tennis. Like, sign me up. So I
So
was
you came to
excited.
it. Wow. So you came to that before our proposal. Oh, that's amazing. What a
Kind of.
coincidence. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So
That's
I
cool.
watched it again for this and it was like, this is great. Yeah.
That's
Yeah.
fantastic. Yeah. That sounds
So.
cool. Yeah. That's an odd mix of it. It's funny. There's three movies. Two of them were utter bombs, I think, when they came out. I think The Late Show did the best of them. I think they did pretty well, I believe. But who cares about box office? We're here about talking about art, God damn it. So, yes.
Yeah, The Late Show did receive an Oscar nomination for screenplay. And yeah, you have Art Carney, Lily Tomlin. It's produced by Robert Altman, Lionsgate Films. And
Yeah.
this is one I think I saw for the first time a few years ago during the pandemic, completely fell in love with it. I watched it at least once or twice before Jed and I did an episode on Terriers, which is another
Right.
SoCal detective show. And
Yes.
you were thinking of things that probably Ted Griffin and Sean Ryan and their entire writing staff probably drew upon. And yeah. I will talk about The Late Show at a drop of a hat. So I loved watching that. And so it had been a little bit. And though I think I might have watched it again, I will watch it whenever TCM runs it. And I think they did earlier this year, but or last year. So I love that one. Cutter's Way, I saw for the first time a couple years ago. My buddy Travis Woods wrote this amazing essay on it. And I was actually wanting to reread it and didn't look for it early enough because I'm sure Travis would have sent me a copy online. And I didn't find it anymore. Like the website has been taken down. So I'm going to have to kind of badger Travis about it, see if we can find an alternative, and I will link to it because, you know, nobody really writes an essay quite like him, especially on a movie like that. Yeah. So I'm happy to go in any order that you would like. Do you want to start with The Late Show?
Let's do that. Yeah, that sounds good to me. A chronological order, roughly, I guess. So 1977, I believe. Yeah, notes.
Yeah, and you were talking about Robert Benton and another movie that you love that he made, Twilight, which I also watched ahead of this. I had seen that in the 90s. I think I saw it at the theater. I mean, the cast, I can't imagine I wouldn't have gone to the theater to see that. I do vaguely remember. Yeah. But I rewatched it and, you know, talking about twists and some of the old noir fallback, the characters and stuff from vintage noir. You have like a femme fatale, you have Hollywood, the glamour, the who's telling the truth. Is he in over his head? Is he a fall guy? So that's a good one. I know that's a movie you love, too. So I'll let you
I mean, that's what you said, Late Show. I first saw that at the New Beverly. I want to say it was 4 or 5 years ago. They had a double feature with, what is the one they did, the sort of sequel to The Maltese Falcon with George Segal. He plays like Sam Spade. It's called Sam's Son of, I'm blanking on the title of this. It was The Late Show with the Son of Sam Spade movie, which is more of a broad comedy. It's not great. Late Show, though, was awesome. That was my first time actually seeing it, you know, a bunch of years ago. So I rewatched it.
And saw it on the big screen. My gosh.
Yeah. And the New Beverly, you know, they show everything on actual film. It was really kind of great to kind of, it feels like you're watching a little bit of piece of history, you know, versus something streamed and piped in. Yeah. But yeah, speaking of tropes, this movie has so much fun with so many tropes. I mean, it opens with the old Maltese Falcon trope of like, you know, Private Eye, whose former partner is dead or his partner's killed.
Yeah.
The difference is in this one, he's killed right in front of him, essentially. He's sort of, you know, Ira Wells is this kind of old, crusty Private Eye living in. I love the set decoration, don't you? It's like just this sad little life, you know?
Yeah, he's in this boarding house and, you know, and he's not supposed to have a woman upstairs. Some of the old fashioned ideas, even though this is in the 70s, he calls everyone doll, which is great. You know, I love some of the dialogue in this movie, but it does open sort of the call to action of my old partner is dead, which Maltese Falcon involves someone's partner or someone that they worked with getting killed. Terriers, which I just referenced and recommend, also opens with that, the similar setup. So yeah. And then we sort of get on, like they've referenced this in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang about, she was loving the sort of the Raymond Chandler-esque novels. And she was talking about how there's always one case and another case and then they intersect or something. And that is exactly what you have here. Lily Tomlin wants her cat back. Damn it. Somebody took her cat, Winston. And, you know, he has no idea what this is going to lead to. Instead of follow the money, we'll follow the cat. And it goes to a bigger and bigger case. Yes.
I mean, it's the oldest like non-hardboiled trope in the book, the search for the missing cat. I mean, really?
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. And then again, Long Goodbye, Altman's Long Goodbye was all about ostensibly the call to action was, you know, Marlowe going out for cat food and comes back and lands in a world of hell, you know. So that's going to be, the cat is a, you know, very neat device. But yeah, it's always the two very different cases that collide in a surprising way. And actually, this mystery is pretty good. I thought it was pretty,
it's twisty,
pretty solid. You know, it's twisty, it's fun, it hits those notes, you know. It's funny though. What struck me when watching this movie is that it was filmed in the mid 70s, and they're referencing a lot of, you know, detective movies from what, the 40s, roughly. Mm-hmm. That's like a 30-year gap. watching it now and going back to the Late Show, that's 50 years. It's just so funny that it was much more recent. Like that was like almost, it had died off. The 60s had a few private eyes like Harper, you know, mm-hmm. They had, you know, a few, you know, but it was hanging on, but the private eye was kind of on the ropes. I mean, in my opinion. And then the 70s brought the private eye back in a big way, in a weird way. A lot of different movies kind of tried to figure out what to do with this old, you know, it's like, what do you do with a cowboy, you know, after decades of like they've fallen out of favor? It's like, how do you resurrect this sort of, you know, icon? And this movie is really interesting. It's like that passing of the baton story, basically, you know, the old crusty PI and his wacky, I use wacky in quotes, you know, kind of a assistant, the amateur in our story, Lily Tomlin, who's fascinating. I mean, she just fascinates me in this movie.
It's such a good idea to give him a female partner too. That's unexpected, because I love what you were saying about like the old gunfighter, because that's something that they always did in Westerns with John Wayne's characters. They would partner him with a young man, like a boy, to kind of make him more virile as he's sort of training, a young guy in. There's the old joke. I was reading a critical study about Rio Bravo, and they were saying in that movie, they saddle him with a drunk, an old man, and a young boy, Ricky Nelson, and a woman. So they really make John Wayne look like, you know, he is the dude. But what's cool about this is she, you know, she doesn't really want to get into this. She's, you know, she is a hippie. She likes her pot. She likes her life as it is. She is a little shady, and we find out more about that. But then as the excitement happens, we have some car chases, dead bodies, all kinds of stuff. She gets into it. And I think that makes it much more fun. Yeah, it reminds me of Manhattan Murder Mystery growing up, seeing that movie. There's a scene where Diane Keaton is like following someone, and she just gets so into it. I think she tells, can't remember if it was Angelica Houston's character or what, she's like, we're going to bust this thing wide open. Like she's doing all the jargon, which is so good. Yeah.
What's funny is, these three movies, it's the amateur's motivation is very different in each one. This one's like, she's reluctant. I mean, she wants something, you know, she wants to fight her cat. But halfway through, you're right, it's this amazing thing where she really gets into it. It's like, oh my God, she's found like this calling. It doesn't quite happen in the other two movies we're going to discuss. It's very different how that plays out. But this one, that was just pure fun to see. Like, you know, she wants to do this now. And she's had a lot of careers, it seems like, right? I mean, she's designs fashion. Yeah. She's like,
She's kind of been dabbling for all kinds of things. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, oh, is this the latest thing for her? Or I was wondering, you know, I almost wonder, is this going to be her calling that will last? Like, will she outlive Ira, you know, and will it be Margot Sterling and partners at some point, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of after stories, like what happens after, you know, the additional movie ends, you know, maybe part of California Bear, not to, shameless plug. It's like all about after your career. If you know, your career being a cop, if you got out of prison, if you're a serial killer, what happens, you know, 40 years later and you're not caught? What do you do? I love those stories. So this has that kind of story, like Ira Wells, you know, what happens to a classic 40s PI who's well known and has solved a lot of cases? Well, you end up in a boarding house, kind of living a sad little life, you know, eating a TV dinner, watching, you know, a tiny screen. And he seems like he's near death. I mean, he really seems like he's unplugged. Yeah,
typing his memoir and just...
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Living the past, literally, you're right. He's doing his sort of memoir until, like, you know, this, again, the call to action. I'm always fascinated by these after stories, you know, what happens after many years pass. This movie has that. And not to ruin the ending, but I do... Again, the ending does put a cherry on top of this whole idea that... I mean, remember the last scene is like... Our two heroes are sitting on a bus bench that's advertising a wax museum, and they're in front of a cemetery, which strikes me as Robert Benton's commentary on the PI genre. It's like a wax museum in front of a place where they store dead things. It's like, to me, very funny, a very funny send off. But interestingly, pardon me, Benton went on to do another retired PI story, basically, with Twilight, not the sparkly vampires Twilight. You know, it's the one that came a few years before, 1998. Amazing. It's one of my favorite PI movies, and it really is just underrated, I think. But a very different take, too, on, you know, I think, you know, Late Show is like more the, like, to me, the Chandler-esque hero, whereas Twilight struck me as more of a Ross McDonald story. Mm-hmm. And Ross McDonald and his Lou Archer novels were all about, you know, long buried secrets coming back to bite you. You know, that's Twilight in a nutshell. It's like things you did 20, 30 years ago are going to come back and haunt you, literally. And a PI is the one who has to figure it out and help you. Almost like serves as a detective as well as a family therapist in a weird way. That's Lou Archer to me, you know, and that's mm-hmm. what, you know, Paul Newman is in Twilight. Same as he wasn't, you know, it's funny. He's playing like a Lou Archer character, not called Lou Archer. And he played Lou Archer, you know, it was Harper, sorry. They changed the name for the movie. But yeah, he's essentially, I mean, that to me was so full of in-jokes about the private eye genre. You have like, you know, the Jim Rockford, you know, you have, you have basically Rockford showing up. Yeah, I mean, Gene Hackman is, you know, so all these, to me, it was just a great, I would love to pick Benton's brain about, between those two movies, like what had changed in his thinking about the private eye genre.
Yeah, and what's so great, I mean, it has the most incredible cast. Also, speaking of Garner, he's living in, I actually wondered if it was Harry Bosch's apartment from the TV show. It looks a lot like that incredible apartment that Titus Welliver's character lived in. That was kind of very Michael Mann-ish, essentially. And that is where...
glass, you know, the windows,
yes,
the wall.
Yes, with all the glass. Yeah. And you're like waiting for him to look out like an Edward Hopper painting, essentially. Which it's funny because his ego gives him away a little bit. But you have Margot Martindale, Reese Witherspoon, Liev Schreiber. You just have the most, you know, Gene Hackman, all of these incredible people.
Susan Sarandon. She's amazing. Susan amazing Sarandon. Femme fatale.
Dr. Channing, like just so many great people, just as far as the eye can see in this movie. Yeah.
And Giancarlo Esposito playing the
I know. I loved his character. Right? Yeah. He's like, I'm your backup. And wait a minute, you waited till I got my ass kicked underneath the dock, essentially, and then came down. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. In the Late Show, too, we have Escobar, almost like these sort of, you know, the Latinx, you know, kind of like not sidekick, but like these sort of, and it kind of resurfaces as Escobar as Esposito's character in Twilight. It's just interesting the tropes that Ben kind of repeats in those two movies in a weird way. Ben, of course, for me, always the first thing comes to mind is Bonnie and Clyde, you know, him writing that with his partner. You know, that was like, well, so I thought he'd have a career in crime, so to speak, but he's done all kinds of movies. I mean, he's done all kinds of wonderful movies. But he picked twice to do the PI genre. I think that's pretty significant to me, at least, that he chose to, you know, to get run at it twice and in very different ways. But
he did. Yeah. Places in the Heart, Kramer versus Kramer. Yeah. All kinds of films for sure. The Ice Harvest he did.
That's right. Great movie.
That is a great one. Yeah. Nobody's Fool. Yeah. I was the weirdo. Oh, and I also loved Still of the Night is a little bit, it's a little slow, but it's Hitchcockian. You have Meryl Streep, Roy Scheider. But Nobody's Fool, again, with Paul Newman. I remember seeing that. I chose the movie. I was the weird kid. I think it was like 94. Who's like, oh, we got to go see the new Paul Newman movie. And it just bored all of my class. I didn't get to choose the movie for a while after that. Then it was, we're going to Legends of the Fall next. I'm like, okay. But let's go see Brad Pitt, not these old people or whatever. But that's a great one, too. Yeah.
Hey, points for choosing the Paul Newman movie. That's pretty awesome. I think that's kind of cool. You should have class way ahead of time. That's really great. So many great movies. You're right. Oh my, Ice Harvest. Yeah, that's not a PI novel by any stretch. But based on the brilliant Scott Phillips novel, it's one of my favorite, you know, holiday crime movies. I watch it, you know, almost every year, rewatch it because it's just fun watching people unravel, you know.
Yeah, I think Nikki said she loves to read the book every Christmas, essentially. And it's a great one. Yes, for sure. And our next, so this one is kind of, the plot is really convoluted, but it's twisty. It's kind of funny. There's chases. Cutter's Way is kind of like a hangover of Vietnam. I sort of wrote it's like sad Coyote Lebowski. I think it was Jed called it sad Lebowski, essentially. And sure enough, Joel and Ethan Coen have admitted that the Big Lebowski, while being, you know, very Chandler-esque, is also taken from Cutter and Bone or Cutter's Way. Essentially, I mean, you have Jeff Bridges, but I think in this one, for me, it's all about John Hurt, who is incredible in this performance. It's really good. It's, you know, it stays with you. It has one of the bleakest, most nihilistic endings. I think you're never going to forget the ending of this movie. But yeah, like I said, I first saw it a few years ago. I think in my review of it for Letterboxd, I said it's kind of like the cinematic equivalent of what Peter Fonda's character was saying with "We blew it" in Easy Rider, essentially. It's like what happened to the promise of the 60s and the 70s after Vietnam in this era. And so talk to me about, I have not read the book. I would love to know more about it.
Oh, the book's amazing. I actually, right here, a little prop, can't see it and for all home listeners, but Cutter and Bone. It's out of print, but it's I whenever I see a copy in the wall, I buy it to give to friends. So I also have, you know, always looking for it. It's a great book. And it's a rare, rare instance, honestly, where the book is very different from the movie. Not very different. It's different in a very big way. But I love both equally. Like, the movie is its own thing, and I just adore this movie. When I first encountered it, though, was in college. I took a course in Vietnam War film, and this is one of them. Like, almost like the after effects. It's not a war movie by any stretch, but it's, you know, the after effects of a war movie. And I remember being like, just bummed out completely. It's a very dark movie. Yeah. As you know, I mean, Sad Lebowski is a way to say it, but it's, I mean, it's funny, but in a very, you know, boy. I remember staggering out of this thing, you know, into like the bright campus, like, what did I just watch, you know? And the book's even bleaker. I mean, the book's really bleak. But, you know, the awful thing that happens, I want to say, you know, in the third act, it's worse than the book because it doesn't happen to one person. It happens to another innocent person. I don't want to spoil things for the book, but boy, is it dark. warning, a little warning for people like go into this thing is the book is brilliant. The writer is Newton Thornburg, who I've been sort of beating the drum for Newton Thornburg recently. He had a really interesting career, full of great promise. And the 70s were his time, you know. I think Cutter's Way was kind of his, if anyone knows him for anything, it's that and Cutter and Bone. But the previous book was a book called To Die in California. It's one of the most powerful books I've read about, you know, grief, about, you know, basically a farmer who goes out to figure out who killed his boy out in California. And it sounds like it's Death Wish, and it kind of, it's Death Wish-y, but not like in a, I'm going to kill all those bastards kind of way. It's more of a, it breaks your heart as he tries to understand, you know, who could kill a young innocent person, you know, or is he innocent? That's the whole question. You don't really know your kids until you start investigating their lives. And boy, it was a great book. So this to me is like, he had a great 1-2 punch in the 70s, Newton Thornburg. We lost him I would say a long time ago, 10 years ago or more. I wish he was better known. I think he's on Kindle. You can find Kindle versions of most of his books anyway. So yeah, Cutter's Way, I watched it in college and thought, wow, bummer, man. I kind of picked up again maybe 10 years ago and started rewatching it just based on, I have a love of California movies and movies set here. And the Santa Barbara they present here fascinates me. I always thought of, you know, as a kid, Santa Barbara sounded like this big, glitzy, sunny place. And it's a weird-ass town. It really is. It's not, you know, there's a lot of weird history there. And it's an interesting place for a Vietnam vet and a gigolo to wash up and try to make their way, you know. Jeff Bridges plays Richard Bone. He's basically, you know, gigolo, not the Richard Gere type. He tries to, you know, sell boats, but also, you know, make a little money on the side from bored housewives. John Hurd, who is, I agree with you, brilliant in this movie, plays, I mean, I can't imagine him being, you know, Mr. McAllister from Home Alone. He's just worlds away from that role. He plays Alex Cutter. He was a very psychologically and physically damaged Vietnam War vet, but his brain's like, you know, hardwired for chaos, you know, it's a triangle. You know, we also have Maureen Mo Cutter, who's married to Alex Cutter, but also there's something weird going on with Richard Bone as well. These guys have known each other for a long time, right? In the sense that there's a lot of weird history here.
Yeah.
They all drink way too much.
Strange codependent love triangle thing happening. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's almost as if like you don't never graduate from that friend set you have in college, right?
Yep.
You all kind of hang and you all know each other's dysfunctions and it's all bizarre and weird and you're stuck in that forever.
Yeah.
That's kind of Cutter's way. You know?
Yeah, that old thing of like, well, he's an asshole, but he's my asshole, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
they're like brothers. They hate. I mean, they hate each other, but they're just annoyed by each other, and they just keep kneeling each other, and it's brutal.
Yeah, they know how to push each other's buttons. It's super uncomfortable. Like, there's a scene early on in a bar where like he's going to kind of bail out the John Hurd, like get out of here, and John Hurd is just riling up bar patrons using racial epithets, and like. You know, Jeff Bridges is trying to kind of put a gloss over everything. And yeah, it's a really, like, you just see that he is someone who's going to be his own worst enemy. You hope he's going to get over it. Kind of like you, we all have that friend where you're like, man, if they just get it together, you know, and, but then you think Jeff Bridges' character doesn't have it together either. The opening of the movie, he's in a hotel with a woman, and it kind of reminded me of like the opening of Body Heat with William Hurt, sleeping with somebody, sort of like these himbos who are kind of trading on their looks, and they're sleazy, it's sweaty. And, you know, they maybe aren't known for having brains, essentially. And so when it when they must rely on like he sees a car behind him and a body is dumped, when he suddenly has to put things together, it's like he's using parts of his brain he didn't even know about. But yeah, John Hurd, this era was Chilly Scenes of Winter. So I think there were some personal demons with John Hurd, unfortunately, that kind of got in his way. And I'm not sure, you know, other opportunities too, of course. He also made a movie in the early 90s I really loved called Deceived with Goldie Hawn. It was Goldie Hawn in a thriller, like Hitchcock mode. I wrote an essay for Jed's site on that one. So it's him playing kind of a scary role, like right after he did Kevin McAllister's dad. So I think, you know, John Hurd has an interesting career, but it's good, I think, if you only know Home Alone, to see something like this.
And he, again, his character fascinates me. It is, the parallels to Lebowski are huge. I mean, like, you know, like John Goodman's character. Yeah, he's a Vietnam vet. John Goodman, though, is more the jolly, you know, conspiracy theory, you know, funny, you know, everything's out to get me. But Alex Cutter is the really dark conspiracy theory guy. he's messed up. There's no cute Pomeranian. This, you know, there's no bowling league. It's like he's just
No Donnie.
There is a Donnie though. The guy, the boat, their Donnie, I argue, is the boat salesman, right?
I guess you
the
can
one,
say that.
He's part of their crew, but not part of the crew. He's the straight laced, you know, guy. You know,
Okay, it has a Donnie.
Right?
Yeah,
I think he's a Donnie kind of. What's missing is the Mo. Like, we don't have the Mo character, you know, I don't think. Yeah. Although, I guess Maud
a little,
maybe.
Yeah.
Kinda.
But, I don't know. Yeah.
But, I mean, but Richard, Jeff Bridges' character, too, Richard Bone's fascinating. He really is, to me, a proto Lebowski. He's like, you know, Lebowski's younger years. He's a little more low. She's a little more, you know, and I'm going to read the first line of Cutter and Bone because it's all about. I love this. My favorite opening lines of a novel. It's very short, so don't worry.
You're fine.
Here it is. It was not the first time Richard Bone had shaved with Lady Remington, nor did he expect it to be his last. I just think it's like, just says it all. It's like he's
such
somewhere.
A good character. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just all right away. It's like, okay, why is he shaving with a chick razor? You know, it's like, what's going on, this dude? I nodded to that in California Bear. There's a Lady Remington reference just because I had to nod to Cutter and Bone. I'm not sure why. But anyway,
that's great. These things you
his
absorb.
His character fascinates me.
Yeah.
And he's also, I mean, I guess it's in terms of our lens of amateur detectives, you know, I think he's the amateur. He's helping out. Like he's the witness. He sees this. He thinks he sees a body being dumped and he thinks he sees who dumped it. And it just so happens to be one of the most powerful people in Santa Barbara. That's not a great thing.
Yeah.
His partner, though, you know, Alex Cutter, he's a conspiracy guy. He sees the vast, you know, just every wrong in the world is thanks to this kind of guy, J.J. Cord, this rich guy. He's to blame for all of our ills. And worse than that, he's dumping 17-year-old cheerleaders in the trash behind bars in Santa Barbara. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. it's just, you know, pretty potent mix of that's their call to action, right?
Yeah.
Bob's Cutter. Wants to, you know, not so much, I think, bring the justice, but get revenge almost, like extort them, mm-hmm. you know. That to me is kind of fascinating. So the amateur impulse here is very different from Lily Tomlin.
Yes.
Lily Tomlin's character, Margot, wanted her cat back. These guys, Alex Cutter wants to, like, I don't know, get revenge on the world for how lousy it
is. That's what I think it is. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you talked about that opening of the book, but there are so many things in this movie that watching it like the second time or a third time, you're going to pick up on. I think one of the sequences that I love so much is like he's a drunk and he's, you know, driven home and he's in this fight with his car and the neighbors and he's screaming his head off at them and like almost coming to blows. And then the police come. And he knows exactly which buttons to push, sort of the, because he's someone, he's like one eye, and he's disabled in a few different ways, and he knows how to use it and bring up Vietnam.
Right.
And it just shows you, like, he is the brains of the operation, but he's also just so mad at the world, and he doesn't know where to put all of this rage, essentially. And
he really does not.
You know, this idea of they killed a young girl and he doesn't know the girl. He doesn't need to. It's just like one of those, the man, essentially. And he decides he's going to go after him. Yeah.
I mean, you said that. It echoes again of Lebowski. It's like, they're going to kill that poor woman. They're going to kill that. It's almost like that echo of like, they got away with killing that poor girl. It's like this, you know, drumbeat of something.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really something interesting.
Something they're using. Yep.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, but it's a downer, and it's funny that the big difference between the movie and the book is it misses the last like third of the novel. Like it stops.
Really?
Like the novel, not to ruin anything, it involves a road trip out to this like rich guy's compound in Arkansas. So it leaves California.
Wow.
Yeah, I know it's great. It's very different, and it's more actiony. You know, the Cutter's Way is not an action movie by any stretch, right? There's no heroics really. There's some pain, but not really heroics. The book's a little more of a more actiony, I guess. Still brilliant. Again, I recommend both to people. I wouldn't say, you know, one is better than the other. I think
they're
both kind of wonderful. But a downer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I spent one last thing I love about the movie too is the score by Jack Nitzsche.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Tremendous. Yeah.
I write to it often. It's like melancholy, it's weird, it's haunting. You know, we know Jack Nitzsche, I guess, from other soundtracks, but, you know, the sort of 60s surf, kind of surf pop he did for a while. And he also was a troubled individual. Won't get into him. But I remember the soundtrack was finally released after many years on, like, CD, like, 5 years ago.
Wow.
I was one of the first, you know, in line to it's great. Yeah, it's pretty wonderful. And if you love the movie, you'll love this soundtrack. So.
Sounds good. And then Mike's Murder, like I said, I was pretty new to this, but I'd love to know your background. Do you remember seeing it when you were a kid or
no,
discovering
actually,
it later?
I discovered it thanks to, it's a great website called Mr. Peel's Sardine Liqueur.
Peter Avellino.
Sure.
Yeah, good friend of mine. Yep.
Yes. I assumed you knew. I see him at the New Beverly every so often, but before I moved to L.A., I was just a huge fan of his blog. I mean, his takes on films are like,
right? Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I love his take on it. He walks you through it. It's part personal, part professional, part everything. It's always very full of heart and full of just great insight. So I first read about Mike's Murder. He wrote about it 10 years ago. And I finally tracked down a copy at some point and watched it. And like, oh, I was like, wow, okay, yeah. This is it's a slow burn. It's very odd. And I didn't realize why it was so odd until, before I get into why it's odd, we should probably explain what it is, right? We have, you know, a bank teller played by Deborah Winger. Betty Parrish is her name.
Yes.
And she has a kind of a one-night stand with this studly, you know, hot tennis instructor guy, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and they sort of see each other every so often over the course of 2 years. It's kind of odd. And then as the title...
Yeah, it's not really too concrete on... Like, I wasn't sure, were they dating? Did they just... Was he just her tennis pro and they just slept together? But, you know, the old, I'm going to call you and he doesn't, that kind of thing. Yeah.
It's like the kind of date who ghosts you, but she can't let go of him. She's always happy to see him, it seems, you know, and keeps tabs on him. His name is Mike Chachutsky. And this isn't a spoiler because it's the title, but Mike gets murdered, you know,
yes.
at a certain point. And she's, to me, Betty Parish, Deborah Winger's character, is the most fascinating of the amateur detectives tonight. This is in this episode because she just like cares.
Yep. I mean,
her motivation is not solving a crime. She's not mad at the world. There's no missing cat. Mike didn't owe her money. There's nothing involved except she wants to figure out what this guy meant to her and what this is.
Yeah.
You know, who was he? Mm-hmm. And you watch her, like, she does like go through the detective kind of steps, the tropes, like the drive through LA. She interviews suspects, but in her own way, it's all, she's so like unassuming. It's kind of beautiful. It's almost the opposite of any every detective you've ever seen. Like, just how, like, she just, right, shows
she
up.
She rolls into it. It's almost like accidental just because she wants to know. It's her friend. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's something a lot of us can relate to. I'm sure everybody has lost somebody, like, you know, one of my college best friends passed away, and, you know, there was no foul play or anything. But you want to know, like, how, why, who was around, what was going on. And so I think for her, it was also, she didn't have any closure. I guess now they use the word like you're in a situationship instead of a relationship or something.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, it was like somewhere between they were not really dating. It was maybe more than a one night stand, but like it was very casual. But he was also just a friend and someone she valued in her life. And and I think also in 84, what's interesting is what we learn about Mike as the film goes on, and then thinking about what, you know, society was like back then. So that's pretty interesting. I'll
it's
let
a great
you
time capsule.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't here at the time, but I mean, early 80s LA, it's just like, wow, they really nail like the west side of LA. You feel like you know the streets pretty well. And she's like this sort of, you know, straight-laced character. Again,
it's
kind of pulled the underbelly. You know, like there's all these, it's about drug dealers. It's about, you know, just more the seedy side of LA. And she's just working in Brentwood, you know, at a bank, doing her thing, playing tennis. You know?
It's a side of the world she didn't know about. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the thing that fascinates me. I didn't realize this till recently, that originally James Bridges, the director, wanted to, and the first edit was in reverse order. Reverse chronological
order.
That's
what I read. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which would have been interesting. I wish we could watch it like that.
I would die to watch that. And I watched, you know, watching it again with that in mind, I thought, wow, if you replay things, I don't want to spoil anything, but like the movie actually has a happy ending if you play it in reverse. Because it starts
very
sad.
Bittersweet. Yeah.
Right?
You can kind of see that. Uh-huh.
I mean, I would just be fascinated by like this, the impulse of like what the through line he takes. Because I mean, if you follow it through, it's like, it's a very intense ending. And then a coda, if you start with the coda and then the intense ending is your opening sequence, like, wow, where do you go from there? It feels like it's sort of, I mean, this is how many years before Memento, you know, Christopher Nolan's Memento. It would have been amazing. I do pray this cut exists somewhere. I'm sure it doesn't, but
I do love that too, because I think just like she was trying to figure out her relationship and what Mike meant to her. It would be interesting for us watching the movie to see that too, because it starts out and she learns something about these people and how did they know Mike. And then if you're just watching, you're like, well, who is Mike? What is going on? And I think then it would get the surprises that we learn about his life and stuff would be maybe more impactful. And it also might just, again, I don't want to get into too many spoilers, but I think it would have been pretty groundbreaking for 84. Yeah,
it would have. And it makes you think, like, the way it is now, it's still, to me, it's a great movie.
Oh, yeah,
as is.
It's interesting.
But it takes you through, like, you know, the traditional, you meet someone at first, you know.
Yeah.
All you see is the side they project to you. They see the positivity, you know, you see all that stuff. And gradually, the longer you know somebody, the more you see the weird stuff that's hidden away, or the quirks, or the, you know, the oddities, the flaws. We all have them.
Oh,
the dysfunctions, the trauma, it all comes out. And imagine starting with, like, you knew all the trauma and it gets erased slowly, slowly, slowly. And all you ended up with is like that beautiful first meeting, you know, whatever it is. That to me is a really fascinating view of
of relationship.
I guess. Right?
It's yeah, kind of because as time goes by, you're going to remember that stuff more. I think when you're in it, you know, the dark stuff, the fighting, sometimes people become friends after they break up. Like, you can't imagine being friends then, but then years later, you remember what this person meant to you or the good beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so that to me is... Of the three movies, I mean, I guess, what's the one that speaks to you the most right now?
For different reasons, I have to go with The Late Show, but I think maybe like quality of film, you're probably going to say Cutter and Bone or Cutter's Way for sure. How about you?
I Cutter's Way for always be kind of the favorite because I just think there's so much going on there. I love Ivan Pastor as a brilliant director. It's Mike's Murder. I can't every time I saw that I can't quite stop thinking about it either. It kind of lingers with you, you know.
And yeah.
It's just so unusual. It's very unusual. You know, I guess it's more of a neo-noir than a classic PI story by sure.
Yeah, but, it doesn't really. I loved what you were saying. It isn't a traditional detective movie. No.
Yet it follows those beats in a weird kind of way. Mm-hmm. The criminals are pretty realistic. Like the guy Pete is Mike's friend. He is, you know,
there's kind of brilliant in that
he's not a mustache twirling bad guy.
Yeah,
he's just a really damaged dude who like is finding himself in a horrible situation and takes it out on innocent people, which I do love when they, you know, movies portray criminals as the you know, how they really are, probably broken, sad people who are just trying to figure stuff out like the rest of us.
They are Bond villains. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And The Late Show was cool to me. It was like, The Late Show felt more old-fashioned than I thought it would be when I first saw it, right? In a good way.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. And it came out, that's the thing about that. It came out only a few years after Chinatown, which really I thought was the ultimate statement on, you know, the class of PI, but set period. But the 70s were a fascinating time to like try to reinvent the PI. And that is a pretty cool example of them doing it. So
yeah, I think that was a really good grouping because we started in 77 and Mike's Murder was 84, I think.
84, but shot 82.
Okay. So it's funny. It's early 80s. Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't do well. The studio, I think it was accused, the studio kind of really just wasn't behind it. I saw this at New Beverly as well a couple of years, it was last year maybe. I saw it with it was a James Bridges festival and I saw Mike's Murder, followed by Perfect, which John Travolta.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Jamie Lee Curtis. Was that the one?
Yes.
Yeah.
The weirdest double I've ever seen. It's the same director, but it's like, what am I watching? This is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's also L.A. It's also fish out of water kind of thing. You know, it's similar stories kind of, but not really. What a
he
weird
was
double.
The Urban Cowboy director, right?
Yes.
Okay. I haven't seen that one
chase.
Since the 90s. The Paper Chase was great. Yeah.
It's really cool. But not to, you know, overpraise them. I should overpraise them because they're awesome. But it's like they do these mini festivals. Like, and I've learned a lot about certain directors by just going a few days in a row and kind of checking out. Oh, it's time for James Bridges to get, you know, some attention. So that's always educational to me.
Yeah. And fun. Absolutely. And I know there were probably several other movies that you could have, we could have worked in here, but I didn't want to keep you forever. Are there any you want to recommend? Maybe some California Hang movies or stuff that, if you've read California Bear, like this world, what would you recommend people check out?
Oh, geez. Well, of course, you mentioned Cisco Pike behind me. That, to me, is very underrated. You know, Kris Kristofferson is a pot dealer who was busted by Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman comes into a lot of pot and forces Kristofferson to sell it for him. So I love Gene Hackman. He's my patron saint. I'll watch Gene Hackman in anything, pretty much.
Yeah.
So this is kind of underrated, you know, great. Also a time capsule of L.A. and like in 72 in this case. I mean, that's what I guess I mean by the Hang movie, where you go, you're watching it, not so much the plot. The plot's cool and it's happening, but it's more hanging with the characters, you know, and kind of seeing what they're all about and their environment. I'm a big fan of place and time in stories. So that was a big motivation, you know. It's funny too, like Cutter's Way was a big inspiration for The Bear, my novel, because it's about these two, you know, weirdos who try to blackmail this powerful individual that, you know, not bring some of the justice. That was very much that's a wrinkle, right? Usually a detective has that code of honor, that Chandler-esque code of honor. I'm a sucker for anything, you know, that 70s, 80s especially, you know, that kind of shows you LA, and it shows people trying to figure it out. Oh, the other one that comes to mind is the Richard Dreyfuss movie, his The Big Fix.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Based on the Roger Simon, you know, novel. It's funny. I can't think of it. Moses Wine, Dreyfuss's character, could easily team up with Margot, was it Sperling? Or is it Sperling, her name? Sterling. I mean, imagine those two, like hippie cop, hippie PIs.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Late 70s.
That could be a sequel. Both... Yeah.
What would you call it? The Big Fix on The Late Show? I don't know what you call it, but it's, yeah, it's those two characters.
The Big Fix
is a great one.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun, too. So, yeah, I mean, I can go on and on, but those are the few that kind of come to mind.
Perfect. Well, Dwayne, I want to thank you so much. What can we expect from you from the future? Anything you want to tease out that you're working on? Are you working on a new novel?
Yeah. I write novels with this up-and-coming unknown writer named James Patterson. He's going to break through someday, I think. You know.
Yeah.
You know,
we're hoping for big things for that kid. Yeah.
I think you know, Jim has it in him. I'm kidding. He's, you know, one of the most prolific and best-selling novelists. But we're working on a new book together. We had a book last year. Actually, it was a PI novel called Lion and Lamb. Came out last August. A very different kind of it's not Cutter's Way. It's more, you know, I think it's more hopefully funny and set in my hometown. So that was but it's very different. It was, you know, two competing PIs. So that was a wrinkle. So I'm working on a new book for him, but also a new book of my own, a new novel that I won't talk about because I don't want to jinx myself. I've had to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. Hear you. I'm a superstitious writer as well. Yes.
But one other thing I wrote last year, a graphic novel. I do comics for Storm King, which is Sandy King Carpenter's, her husband's John Carpenter, the director.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sandy King Carpenter does, you know, kind of horror comics. They have a new line called Dark and Twisted. And I did a kind of a weird sort of historical murder mystery for them set at a hotel about 8 blocks from where I live currently. So that was really cool. Fun setting a story in a creepy place. It's a haunted hotel. I get my hair cut there. And then my barber tells me ghost stories in this haunted hotel.
So nice.
I decided, of course, to set a murder mystery there because why not? And it's being worked on now. I'm not sure it'll be out this year, but it's close to it, hopefully.
Okay.
The art's still underway.
That sounds great. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It was a real pleasure to talk about some of these movies with you and just always to check in. Yeah.
Yeah. See, thank you so much, Jen. It's awesome. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. You have to come up with another idea and come on back for sure.
I will. Okay. You got it. What a pleasure.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching. This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.